Hey, everybody. Welcome to Sweater Weather, a podcast about Canadian arts and culture. I'm Aaron Giovannone, a writer in Calgary.
And I'm Naomi Lewis, a writer in Calgary as well.
How you doing, Naomi?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm good.
I'm excited to get down to this topic.
Before we get to the topic at hand, we do have a little bit of housekeeping to take care of. Mm. Well, everybody, we did it. There was mass clamoring for this, but we brought down the paywall. We decided that we want the show to be available to everybody in their entirety. This is maybe the largest wall to fall since 1989.
Huh? Maybe.
Why did we decide to bring down the paywall, Naomi?
Because we've been making these fairly long.
Long but good. Every minute is delicious.
And we don't want anyone to miss it.
That's
it
right.
It just hurts our hearts to think that, you know, that we'd be holding out and demanding cash for the wonderful insights that we have to offer.
Well, let's not give anyone the idea that we don't want or need their cash.
No, but we don't want it to be contingent on that.
No, that's right.
Yes, of course we do both want and need cash.
That's right. So yes, we're going to be going to just a purely a donation-based model. We'll be putting out an episode every 2 weeks, as we have been recently. Mm-hmm. It'll be available in its entirety for free. I guess to help out the show, it'd be really great if people, you know, like and share the show wherever they see
sure
it on social media, because mm-hmm. we're on all the social media platforms. And if you do want to donate to the show, become a regular supporter of Sweater Weather, you can still do that at the same place, patreon.com/Canadian Sweater. Patrons do get some perks. You know, mm-hmm, there's some nice mm-hmm. things associated with being a patron, besides our infinite gratitude, of course.
Like what?
Well, you get early access to all new episodes of Sweater mm-hmm. Weather. So they'll be on Patreon available for patrons before they are for the they're available to the general
That's
public.
A good perk.
That's right. There'll be occasional bonus content. I think once we have more patrons and it's feel sort of worth it to make something just for them, we'll be putting out something occasionally just mm-hmm. for them. And you know, if you become a regular supporter, you'll be helping make this, I think, unique CanCon podcast.
Absolutely.
I don't think there's anything else out there like us right now.
Not that I know of. And also, I mean, if we get enough donations, if we get enough donors, then we'll be able to continue making the show and making it often, which is what we really want.
We have lots of great plans for future episodes. I think we're sticking to kind of nostalgic 80s, 90s
for now.
CanCon for the moment, mm-hmm. just to build a base, I think, to situate ourselves historically.
Mm-hmm. And it makes sense for us to start there just because that's where our experience of Canadian culture begins.
That's right. And nobody, and again, I don't think anyone else is really doing that, at least not regularly or systematically mm-hmm. like we are. So we have upcoming episodes. What might they be? I know we're going to talk about the kind of teen show, young adult show, Are You Afraid of the Dark,
mm-hmm.
in an upcoming episode.
And we're going to have a special guest on to talk with us, right?
We'll be having guests. Yeah, mm-hmm. we'll be having guests.
Okay.
That's something we'd like to add to the show as mm-hmm. well, as bringing in guests. Other topics?
I think we've discussed The Tragically Hip as a
sure.
potential topic. Maybe Tom Green, the Canadian comedian, I suppose is what he is.
Tom Green's back in Ottawa, mm-hmm. his hometown of Ottawa.
Or nearby, I hear. But
from Ottawa, like today's topic, Alanis mm-hmm. Morissette.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And we have many, many others.
I think last week...
The Handmaid's Tale, we'd like to talk about the original Margaret Atwood book.
Yeah.
And how it became a TV show, perhaps. Yeah.
That Google Doc of 80-something topics is now like 100-something topics, so mm-hmm. it keeps growing. And if you have suggestions... you have any other comments about the show, send us a message, sweaterweatherpod@gmail.com.
Yeah, and at this point, Aaron's not talking to me, he's talking to you.
It's okay. I think I'm going to experiment with never looking at the camera.
Okay,
because I hate the way I look when I'm looking at the
camera.
Yeah,
I don't like the way I look either.
I prefer the profile.
Yeah, yeah.
And
I mean, I think you have a great front face as well.
Well, I enjoy your front face as well.
Thank you.
But it's... And maybe it's more natural. It feels more natural to talk this way.
To a person rather than a camera.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. So.
Yeah. Fair.
Right. All right, on with the show. Let me share my first thoughts on Alanis Morissette, my earliest memories of her. So I remember I was a skateboarder in the 1990s in high school.
Of course, you were.
For much of high school. Mm-hmm. And I remember, you know, being outside in a parking lot in St. Catharines, Ontario, skateboarding, you know. And we'd skateboard to music, mm-hmm. probably annoying everybody mm-hmm. nearby. It would be Beastie Boys, it would be Rage Against the Machine. And I think maybe we even had the radio on. Mm-hmm. And so an Alanis Morissette song came on. It was One Hand in My Pocket. And I remember one of my skater friends making fun of the song, making fun of the lyrics, like, I've got one hand in my pocket and the other one is scratching my behind. Something like that. It was probably more crass than that, but we're not that kind of a podcast. So I'm going to clean it up. You know, I don't like crass humor.
I feel like a young man on a skateboard could come up with something better than that. I believe you.
I think
something
it was,
more crass.
Excuse
I mean.
Me. Oh,
something more crass.
Yeah, thank you. Better, please.
No, I mean better in the sense of worse.
And I felt, I didn't say anything. Probably laughed.
Mm-hmm. But what were you thinking and feeling?
Well, I was thinking that, I actually kind of like this song. Mm. I find it rather catchy.
Uh-huh.
But I was, you know, silently defensive of the song to myself.
Interesting.
And otherwise, I didn't have big opinions about Alanis. Her songs, there were so many of them on the radio, those years, 95, 96. And whenever they were on, I tended to like them. I just thought they were... They were catchy radio songs.
Did you own the album?
No.
Okay. Did anyone in your household own the album?
I don't know if my sister did. Mm. I think maybe not quite her style.
Okay. Fair. Right. Yeah, that makes sense. Well, can I tell you about my first memories of Alanis? Okay, well,
do.
I'm going to start with one. It's not my first memory of her, but of the album, Jagged mm-hmm. Little Pill. Mm-hmm. So in June 1995, when this album first came out, I was in my last year of high school,
mm-hmm.
and I must have just finished high school, or I was just finishing high school that month, and I was 19. So,
yeah.
I'm older than you, as we know, and so 3 years older than you, so when I was 19, you were 16, so I think that partly explains the difference in our experiences at this point. So anyway, I was 19, I was finishing high school, and I was visiting my friend at work who worked in a thrift store in downtown Ottawa,
mm-hmm.
and... The song came on the radio, and I said to my friend, I was like, my friend was like very knowledgeable about music, especially kind of indie punk music. And I was like, what is this? This song just kind of like rattled me. And I was like, what? I don't know how, like my brain just can't process the song. It's so catchy, but somehow like overproduced, and it sounds kind of like Pearl Jam, but it's a girl. And it's like, what the heck is this? And she was like, yeah, it's Alanis Morissette. And I was like, what? And then she was like, yeah, at first I thought it was Annie DeFranco gone mainstream. But then I realized it's actually Alanis Morissette. And of course the song was You Oughta Know. And so I said, what? And my brain completely exploded. I couldn't think about anything else for the rest of the day. Is because I grew up in Ottawa. I went to not the same high school as Alanis Morissette, but the other high school that was kind of its competitor down the street.
You were in the neighborhood, like you lived in the neighborhood that Alanis was from and went to high school.
Right. Yeah. And my sister went to that high school, and a lot of my friends went to that high school.
Glebe Collegiate Institute.
Glebe, right. So I actually, from where I lived, was supposed to go to Glebe, but I switched high schools. I went to a different high school ostensibly because I wanted to play the violin, but really because... I deemed my junior high school years a social failure and wanted to
just start over.
Wanted to start over as a new cool version of myself, which one does. So anyway, I did not go to the same high school as Alanis, but a lot of my friends did. She was 2 years older than us, which is like a major social divide at that age. Mm. But she was kind of like the talk of the town. She had an album out that was like quite a sensation, at least.
We'll get into it, all the details.
Okay.
I have, yeah.
And so she was famous for that, but kind of like infamous for that because the album was like not what you would call cool in the 90s. It had more of a like late 80s, early 90s vibe to it. It was very poppy. You'll explain that. But like long story short, I think she was kind of mocked a lot and bullied a lot. And like, I kind of knew her as the butt of a joke, unfortunately. Teenagers are not very nice. And in the 90s, especially, we were not very nice, especially about kind of naked ambition and earnestness, mm-hmm. both of which Alanis Morissette, or Alanis, as she was then called, seemed to embody.
Right.
So, but I do remember one of my friends excitedly telling me, my friend who went to Glebe, that she had peed that day in the stall next to Alanis, who was also peeing. So she did have a certain local celebrity, and my friend said it like kind of as a joke, but kind of not. Like, she was kind of genuinely excited. So she had that level of...
At that, this is 90, so we're talking 93.
Early 90s.
She graduated, Alanis graduated high school in 1993.
Yeah, so it was, we were in grade 9 or something.
Right. She was a, like, a decently known Canadian yeah. pop star. So there's, I can imagine that high school kids would at once admire her and also loathe her.
Yeah.
Find lots to criticize, I'm sure.
Oh, sure. And I mean, also, she sang the national anthem on the announcements at that high school.
Mm-hmm.
Which people...
Oh, that's interesting. She would do both. That at, like, every day?
No, I think it was a recording, if I understand correctly.
Wow, I wonder if her father had something to do with that. We'll find out.
And there was a local rumor that her father had, like, bought her fame, had basically just, like...
Well, her father was a high school principal. I actually don't know what high school it was.
But, you know, of course, if someone in high school is sort of, like... a bit of a celebrity, everyone else is not going to be nice to them, at least in the 90s. I think kids might be nicer now, but let's just leave it at that.
I think everybody's probably jealous.
Oh, yeah. But also just kind of eye-rolling because
she... and especially in the 90s. In the 90s, you'd eye-roll at that stuff.
Like, she had no... there was no irony to her and her music at that point. And that is why I was especially like, what the hell? This is a lesson.
What she was doing, her music at that time for hip kids was not cool.
Not at all. And I mean...
it was geared toward the radio market, maybe music producers who were in Canada, maybe stuck a couple of years behind.
Yeah.
Yeah, the trends.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, like she had a big perm, too, and like big hoop earrings and stuff.
If you look at those old videos now, it's like it looks very different than Alanis a couple of years later.
Oh, yeah, so... when I heard this song in the thrift store in downtown Ottawa, and suddenly it was like, what the hell? Like, Alanis Morissette, first of all, she's clearly left Ottawa and gone on to something a lot bigger. She has this, like, highly produced, like, grunge-sounding sort of album that is the opposite of, like, her Paula Abdul thing that she was doing before. And then the video, again, is like, what on earth? So, I mean, I have to say that seeing this, so from my perspective, as an Ottawa, former Ottawa snotty teenager who was like into the punk scene, Riot Girls, I was in a punk band, I was like anti-selling out, which is a big concept that I think kind of surrounds like, well, it's interesting. I feel like I could talk about the whole concept of selling out and like what it really meant and how it doesn't really mean anything anymore. But anyway, like, she was a big sellout, clearly. She had, like, entered show business through the front door, let's say. Like, she had started out as a child wannabe celebrity and then had seemed to, according to local rumor, bombarded her way into becoming a real celebrity. Or had her parents buy her way. I mean, this was what people said.
Yeah.
It's not nice, and I'm not saying it's true. I'm saying this is what I thought at the time. And so... like, seeing her suddenly turn into a completely different character, like, it felt incredibly packaged and produced and, like, orchestrated. I don't know how else to say it.
Yeah.
And, like, very big budget.
At the time. Yeah.
And so I never really allowed myself to consider liking her music.
Yeah.
For better or for worse. So that's... where I was coming from with Alanis Morissette.
Yeah, I have to say, I would never have said that I was a fan.
Yeah.
I said I'd listened and enjoyed more or less radio songs, would never have gone to an Alanis concert, or bought a CD.
Mm-hmm.
But after researching this episode, I feel a little different about Alanis. I have to say, I admire and appreciate her and her music. More than I did before.
Hmm, interesting.
So maybe you will too.
Yeah, maybe. And I mean, also looking back, part of what I feel about that time and how I felt about her is a kind of shame and stupidity for, I mean, obviously when it comes to like the high school, whether or not she felt that high school, I don't even know if it was bullying or disdain or whatever, like, she certainly won that one.
Yeah, I think she's doing all right.
But also, like, some of the, like, anger and hurt that you hear in her songs, like, sometimes I think back and wonder if, like, her teenage years. I mean, she talks about her teenage years being hard in certain ways. Mm-hmm. And even though I never met her, I feel like a sort of, like, worse than a bystander to that. Because I made fun of her for sure, like, actively.
As a teen.
As a teen.
Right. Well, we've all grown up a little bit, huh?
Hopefully, in the last 30 years, so we've made some progress.
We've got a little bit of, you want to delve into some background?
Please.
About Alanis? So we already talked about her being from Ottawa. So she was born in 1974. I already mentioned her father, Alan, was a high school principal and a French teacher. And her mother was also a teacher. So insofar as they could buy her way into show business, I think as solid middle-class people with disposable income, they could certainly nurture her, get her lessons, pay for studio time. They could afford it that much, I'm mm-hmm. assuming. She has a twin brother.
Hmm.
Yeah, born 12 minutes before her, and she has another older brother. As a little kid, she did dance and piano lessons. She was raised Catholic, and she sang in the church choir. That was the first time she found out that she liked performing and got compliments for performing was performing in church.
Oh, very nice.
Now, she was a showbiz baby. And that, a showbiz baby. I mean, she was a kid brought up in show business because her father had always kind of wanted to be in show business himself and encouraged / pressured her to, I think, do arts.
Just her, not her brothers?
Maybe it was Alanis that had showed the inclination or the talent.
Mm-hmm.
She told Howard Stern in 2004 that her childhood was, quote, horrible and wonderful, referring to the pressure she felt to succeed in show business at a very young age. In 1986 and 1987, when she was just 12 and 13, Alanis appeared on the kids' sketch comedy show You Can't Do That on TV.
On television. You can't do that on television.
You can't do that on television.
Yeah, that was a big hit when I was growing up in Ottawa. I remember it being on all the time. And I had several friends who had been on it.
Future topic of sweater weather. You can't do that on television. It was filmed in Ottawa. This show ran for 10 seasons.
It was not very good.
It's terrible. I mean, I think it's terrible.
I don't remember ever liking it. I just remember it being on. Like, it was supposed to be funny, but it wasn't funny. People were always getting slime dumped on their head.
So it ran for 10 seasons. It played on CTV in Canada and on Nickelodeon, which was a relatively new network in the United States. And this show popularized getting slimed when green slime is dropped on a kid, because it's Nickelodeon. That became a staple event on Nickelodeon. This became a thing. It was part of their logo. Their like transition graphics would have slime coming down. It came from this show. This show is like, we tried to watch like 2 minutes of it and it was terrible.
Yeah.
It was like, wait, anyway, we'll just save that for the episode.
Try not to get distracted by the slime.
We already talked about Alanis going to the Glebe Collegiate Institute. Now, when she was 13, she recorded an album, a demo, at a Toronto studio, and this was released nationwide. And there are like radio interviews of a 13-year-old Alanis promoting this album. She appeared on television and other public events regularly, singing the national anthem at her high school, which would make you maybe loathed by others, by many others in your high school. But there's early footage of her at a Ottawa talent show.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like really funny because it's like little Alanis singing. And the other contestants are like grown adults who do ballroom dancing or someone else who like juggles. And they're all standing there at the end and they announce the winner. And it's Alanis. It's really funny.
Yeah, she's a star.
She's a star from early on. So in 91, when she was 16, 17, she released the dance pop album, Alanis.
That's the one I remember.
With MCA Canada. So this was a big record label in Canada.
Yeah.
It went platinum in Canada. She had a top 20 single with a song called Too Hot.
Which I remember well. I remember the video very well, too.
She was nominated for 3 Junos, and she won one.
That's amazing.
So she was more than just, like, an ambitious amateur at this point.
Yeah, I wish she ever. And like, I also have to say, we went back and watched that video, and she was a really good dancer as well. I mean, she must have spent all her time practicing, singing, dancing. Like,
yeah,
that's not easy.
Yeah. I mean, it takes an incredible amount of work.
Yeah.
After that album, she opened on tour for Vanilla Ice.
Did she?
She did. Huh. In 1992, she sang the national anthem at the NHL All-Star Game in Montreal. And she also sang the national anthem that year at the first ever game of the Ottawa Senators. So the Ottawa hockey team was opening the franchise that year. At the All-Star Game in Montreal is where she met comedian and Full House actor Dave Coulier.
Okay. And how old was she?
She was 18.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right? Yeah. He was 34. And Dave Coulier will enter as kind of Alanis lore.
Indeed.
And we'll get to that a little bit more later. Now,
Alanis. Okay, so 18 and 34 is not something that we approve of in this day and age, but I suppose I just won't say anything more about that.
There's a lot more. There's a lot more to be said about that.
Sure. I'm sure we're going to get there.
Alanis has talked about having sexual relationships with much older men who worked in the music industry. On Howard Stern's show in 2004, Alanis said that when she was 15, she dated a record producer who was in his late 20s. And that when she was 17, she dated a record executive who was 50 years old.
50, wow. 17 and 50.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say that, well, as we have talked about more and more in our culture in, you know, recent years, women all have stories like this. If a young girl is in a work environment with a lot of older men, or any kind of like ongoing environment with a lot of older men, like, this is inevitably, seems to be what has unfolded historically, unless something is there to stop it. So there's an awful lot of women with this story, and it seems like Alanis is one of the first to really talk about it in her music and in general, like way before the Me Too movement, which is quite interesting. And nobody really paid much attention to what she was saying until it became a very prominent cultural conversation with, Harvey Weinstein and the Me Too movement. And then suddenly we notice like the people that have been talking about this for a really long time. And Alanis Morissette is one of those people.
So even back in 1995 on Jagged Little Pill, she talks relatively explicitly about a sexual relationship with a powerful older man. Seems like probably an executive of some sort in the song called Right Through You.
Mm-hmm.
And,
the thing about the ass and the golf. You looked at my ass and then you played golf. I mean, just from that description, you picture this young girl kind of, I mean, at least I do, and maybe I'm imbuing this with too much meaning, but this young girl and this old, rich, executive type guy who can just casually demean her and then go off and live his like older man executive life and not give it a second thought.
Yeah, it's very evocative, that even just those couple of lines.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. She sang about this kind of dynamic too in Hands Clean. This was a single from 2002, so a couple of albums later. And it had a video that made this theme explicit, with older men like kind of being leering or weirdly sexual or threatening.
Mm.
I don't know if you're familiar with Hands Clean. This was a number one hit in Canada. And I think in a few other places.
I'd probably recognize it if I heard it.
I think it's a really good song, actually. I'd say one of its, I remember at the time thinking, oh yeah, again, it was like a catchy radio song. How does it go? Oh yeah, it's the song goes like, we'll fast forward to a few years later.
Oh yeah.
And no one knows except the both of us.
Yeah.
And it's like about an illegal... legal / immoral relationship.
Right, and he's washed his hands clean of it. And it's
he's forgotten or pretends to have never...
He's playing some golf.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, there's no reference to golf in this one.
I know.
I find this a much more fulsome kind of exploration of that theme, and I like this song quite a bit. Yeah, but I had, yeah, I didn't know it was about that. I never thought of that. Mm-hmm. And I don't even know how much that was even in the press or talk about the song at the time, 20 years ago.
You know, I feel like these kinds of stories, like when I say that people didn't notice or didn't care, it's not exactly that, because certainly women both noticed and cared.
Yeah.
And there's always, you know, there's been stories written about this and novels and short stories and songs. And it's not that people, that women, like, let me just say women, I'm sure that this is true of some men too, but like women recognize the story as true.
Yeah.
And I think before Me Too, it was a kind of recognition that was just like, yeah, that's the way it is and it sucks, rather than the like righteous anger that has replaced that.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, so I just want to go back and say it's not exactly that people didn't notice or care, that when people were telling these stories, including Alanis Morissette, no doubt, it's more that it was like this kind of accept, like, yes, that sucks, and yes, that happens, and probably with women, like, that, yes, that's probably happened to me, or like, if not me, my best friend, or my sister, or whatever, but like, I don't think there's anything I can do about it.
So, There was a 2021 HBO documentary about Alanis Morissette's life and career. She participated in the documentary. There's an extensive interview with her included in it. And there she includes stories of trauma and mentions that she believes that she was the victim of statutory rape.
Now, she knows she was.
No, but Alanis was unhappy with the film and with their inclusion of those remarks. And she criticized the filmmaker for luring her into exposing herself more than she felt comfortable with. And Alanis boycotted the premiere of the movie. So in the end, even though it was all about her, she ended up not approving of it in the end. And there were a lot of headlines at the time mentioning, wow, Alanis Morissette says that she was raped. So her next album is called Now Is the Time. This was released in 1992. Now, she was trying to turn towards more singer-songwriting style with ballads, and it didn't sell as well as her other album.
I never knew that existed.
And her label dropped her after it. They didn't like what direction she was going in. So kudos for her for trying something new and paying the consequences for it, actually. In 93, she finished high school, moved to Toronto. She found a new manager, and she continued to like sort of develop her music. Now, I think it's in late 93 or maybe early 94 that her family sends her to L.A. to try something new.
Okay.
She's been, as I said, dropped from her label in Canada.
Did she ever go to university?
I don't believe so.
Okay.
Now, once in L.A., she was put in contact with a well-known producer named Glenn Ballard. He had participated in the recording of Michael Jackson's albums Thriller, Bad and Dangerous.
Wow.
He co-wrote songs, including Man in the Mirror. He'd worked with artists, like female artists, like the Pointer Sisters, Wilson Phillips, and Paula Abdul, who you already mentioned. And after Alanis, he would go on to work with many more artists too. So Ballard and Morissette, they hit it off immediately as a songwriting duo, Alanis doing the lyrics mostly, you know, Ballard doing the music, and Ballard also producing the songs. So between February 94 and February 95, they co-wrote all the songs from Jagged Little Pill.
Okay.
They did demo tapes of them.
Amazing.
They worked in his home studio, and Alanis claimed that she could write a song, or they did write songs in like 15 to 30 minutes. Now, I suppose that's for the lyrics. Ballard said it took more like 8 hours to produce a song at the time.
Okay.
That's how quickly they were working.
Wow.
Now, once it was done, labels turned it down, but they did finally get picked up by Maverick Records. This is the label owned by Madonna.
Right.
So the first single, famously, probably still her most famous song ever, honestly, is You Oughta Know.
Mm-hmm.
It featured guitar from Dave Navarro of Jane's Addiction and bass from Flea of Red Hot Chili Peppers. They both played on this track.
I didn't know that.
So in early 95, the LA rock station K-Rock FM, this is a very influential station, they put the song in heavy rotation it became a hit right away. It was the number one most requested song for several weeks. You mentioned hearing the song and being kind of, struck by it.
Oh, yeah.
For many reasons.
Big time.
And MTV and Much Music played the video a whole bunch, too. The song would peak at number one on the alternative charts and numbers in the U.S. and number six in Canada. And I do say, it is her most iconic song still, right? Mm-hmm. So, like you mentioned this already, she had changed her style a lot,
mm-hmm.
right? In Canada, the early press about Alanis' new thing focused on this changed image and sound. So if you look at a Much Music interview from 95, it's all about how Alanis has changed.
Mm-hmm.
She claimed that she hadn't found her voice before. She says now, quote, "I wasn't as fearless as I am now." The album came out in June 1995. It produced six singles. After You Oughta Know, there was All I Really Want, Hand in My Pocket, Ironic, You Learn, and Head Over Feet.
Wow.
It was on radio. It just seemed to dominate radio.
Sure did.
I remember hearing it so yeah. much. And this was an era when you always had, the radio was on a lot.
And also, the videos were always playing on Much Music.
Yes. Yes. She has some iconic videos, mm-hmm. for sure. For sure. Now, Jagged Little Pill was in the top 20 for an entire year. It ended up selling 33 million copies worldwide. She did a world tour.
That is a kind of massive number that's hard to
fathom. It's hard
to fathom. Yeah.
It's the second biggest selling album of the 90s, and it's the 12th best selling album of all time. It won six Junos and four Grammys.
What was the best selling album
of all time? I don't know. Of the 90s, I think it's Metallica.
Okay.
Yeah, Metallica's Metallic, self-titled, I think. She's a superstar. Really fast.
Mm-hmm.
Alanis discovered yoga during the tour for Jagged Little Pill. Iyengar yoga. So at the end of this big long tour, she went to India for 6 weeks with friends and family. And her next album would be influenced by Eastern
practice. Oh, yeah. Thank you, India.
Her song.
Thank you.
It was called Thank
other
You.
Other stuff. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you, India. Thank you, frailty. Thank you, disillusionment.
Okay, so she's kind of going for the Buddhism, the yoga.
Oh, yes. Well, in 1998, her next album comes out. It's called Supposed Former Infatuation Junkie. It's its themes are religious and mystical and critical. A lot of them are critical of fame and wealth and stuff like that. It was also co-written with the guy, Glenn Ballard, from the big hit Jagged Little Pill.
Mm-hmm.
So it has that rock grunge sound, but the lyrics are kind of going in another direction a little bit,
mm-hmm.
a little bit more mystical, I would say. The album cover has phrases from the five precepts of Buddhism.
Oh, really?
So she's really into it.
Okay.
She's really into it. Now,
can I just add something here? I read an article that was about her, an interview with her when her spoiler alert, musical of Jagged Little Pill came out a few years ago. And it was kind of discussing her whole career and how she was compared sometimes unfavorably to Hole and Babes in Toyland and those Riot Girl bands and wanted to befriend people like that and was rejected by them.
Because she was too mainstream.
Yeah. But what the author said that I really liked was that, it's not really fair to compare her to those people and those artists because it's the difference between protest and therapy.
Okay.
And I really, really like that distinction because I think that if you're thinking, because Alanis was often touted as an angry woman, angry white female was what it said on the cover of Rolling Stone when her photo was first on Rolling Stone. And so one could easily think that what she was trying to do was a kind of protest music. And You Oughta Know had this super angry vibe to it.
Oh,
right?
Yeah, absolutely.
But at the same time, her music was always I'm mad, but it's okay. The lyric, everything's going to be fine.
From
that kind of sums up her, I'm really mad, but I'm going to be okay. Everything's actually okay and it's all good. And I think that author, I think her name is Rachel Symes, who wrote the article that I read. I think that's such a great distinction that she makes. This isn't protest, it's therapy.
Right.
And it's really not fair to judge it as protest music.
Right. Comparing it to more avant-garde.
Or more just pure anger, purely fuck this, that, you know, the kind of those kind of Riot Girl bands were doing more, you know, where like there is no like everything's going to be fine in there. There is no like, you know, I suggest getting naked in your living room or whatever.
Yeah, just like live it up, everyone.
And like and but it's not just live it up. It's also, it's this wisdom. It's this kind of like yoga-y, Buddhist-y wisdom vibe of wisdom that Alanis is going for, where like she, like you often see her in her videos with this kind of beatific, serene look on her face. and she says things like you live, you learn, you love, you learn. Like it's always this kind of like, or thank you, India. Thank you, frailty. Like it's this kind of, and I mean, to be fair, this is written by a very young woman who was discovering, trying to get past like some trauma and find like a more positive way of looking at things, right? Like that's not what everyone wants. Not everyone's looking for a positive way of looking at things. Some people just want to protest and change things. She wants to be at one with the universe, right? Like that's a really different vibe.
It is. Well, this album had a different vibe. It was like a number one. It debuted number one. It had that one major hit, Thank You, but only one, like, compared to the other one, it had six. So people saw it. It sold 8 million copies. I mean, this is still a huge album, but like people considered it kind of a sophomore jinx. But it actually was actually showing like Alanis is like changing and developing her style. So critics didn't really like the album, but critics often didn't like her music. But anyway, this is one guy, David Brown of Entertainment Weekly. He wrote in 2000 that supposed, what is it called again? It's so hard. Supposed former infatuation junkie, that this album was, quote, the biggest clunker of the decade, and, quote, was corporate grunge and victim culture whining incarnate. So he hated the
victim culture.
Right. So I have to say that, like, just on your, like, I've watched, preparing for this, I watched interviews with Alanis from all throughout the decades. And I have to say, this is, like, it's hard listening to an interview with her in this era. Just like in all, just like I'm trying to be as generous as possible here, because this is someone who's like in her mid 20s.
Yeah, the
extremely oldest. Famous, has had immense like success.
Everyone's always telling her she's amazing.
Yeah, and with all the other trials and tribulations of being, you know, working hard and encounter, yeah, being abused,
having been a child star,
all these things. So I'm just want, but like she is so smug in interviews of this era, it is so hard to take. So in a 1990 interview with Charlie Rose, she talks about going on what she calls a goddess trip to India. She says things like this, quote, I can't believe the sounds coming out of my own mouth because they are so amazing.
Like her songs?
Yes. And she says, quote, I am already perfect on a spiritual level.
Really?
In Kevin's, she appears in Kevin Smith's 1999 movie Dogma, so around this time.
Oh,
Alanis
right.
Morissette, and I think, I mean, obviously there's some self-awareness here, I suppose, but playing on this idea that Alanis Morissette is God. She actually plays God.
Yeah, I remember that.
That's right. She appears very briefly. So
didn't realize that she actually believed herself to have like achieved nirvana.
I don't feel I'm misrepresenting what I encountered in that interview. It was pretty rough.
Me just say though, I mean this is an obvious caveat to everything, but who would want to be held up to scrutiny for what they said, did, and believed, and like not like they're
in your mid twenties.
Yeah, not to say your teens. I mean, geez Louise, this poor woman can never.
Well, even go back to her initial change to grunge Alanis from pop Alanis.
Yeah.
She was university age. Literally, instead of going to university, she went to LA to become a music star. What does everybody do when they go to university? They get new clothes, they get friends, they often like try out new stuff.
Totally.
And this is kind of her like doing the next thing, which is like a spiritual awakening. As I said, she really got into Eastern.
But you know, I just have to say, like from my like snotty 19-year-old perspective, when I was like, oh, now Alanis is pretending to be grunge. Like maybe she's being sincere when she says that what she was doing before was like packaged by other people.
Yeah.
And that what she went on to do with Jagged Little Pill was actually felt more authentic, was what she really wanted to do.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, of course, people change between their teens and 20s, but also maybe she kind of, like, she left her parents' house. That's kind of a, you know, a big step mm-hmm. when you're finding that your age. Own voice.
That's right. Right. That's right. Yeah, she left her parents. I hadn't thought of that, but of course, she left her parents
yeah.
and gone to LA.
And her so. Hometown.
That's right.
And all these, like, creepy men that have been creeping on her.
That's right. Her next album in 2002, already in interviews of this era, I'm like, oh, I like Alanis Morissette again. She's okay. like, I feel like she's got her feet on the ground a little bit more. That album was called Swept Under the Rug. That has a song, Hands Clean, which we already talked about. She did the music and the lyrics. She wrote the music and the lyrics oh, for that wow. album. And so that's, yeah, and that song, that is like about problematic relationships with older men. It's interesting that that's when she makes that song. Okay, now in 2002, Alanis appears on an episode of Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Yes.
As well. And she's quite funny, actually.
Yeah, she's
did you
good.
Did you watch that clip?
Of course, I've seen all of Curb Your Enthusiasm.
So she's performing at Larry's house. She's doing yeah. like a private acoustic concert for him and his friends. She gets a like whiplash in a car accident, and then like when
and it's Larry's fault.
It's Larry. Well, it's a friend's. Yeah, so roundabout way, it's Larry's fault, of course. And oh, she told Larry secretly who the song "You Ought to Know" is about.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's like a little joke in the episode. But like the sight gag is her. Playing You Ought to Know, and they cut to her and she has like a neck brace on.
I remember that.
It's just, so she's kind of having a hard time getting the music, the words out. It's kind of funny. So she has another album in 2004 called So-Called Chaos. That year, 2004, she hosted the Juno Awards. She dressed in a bathrobe, took it off to reveal a flesh-colored bodysuit.
Okay.
Do you remember this?
No.
This was a response to Janet Jackson getting in trouble for the breast nipple. Flashing mm-hmm. incident. Yeah.
The costume malfunction?
The costume.
Wardrobe malfunction. The infamous wardrobe malfunction.
Right.
And so Alanis was protesting like the scandalization since the sensationalization of female nudity.
Yeah, or the, what would you call it?
Overreaction.
The censorship of it, the overreaction, the moral panic.
Yeah. Moral panic's a good word, term for it, for sure.
In 2005, she released an acoustic version of Jagged Little Pill, sold exclusively at Starbucks.
Really?
Yeah.
Hey, yikes.
This, you can see her, going, this is the beginning of like the relentless repackaging and reselling
yeah.
of her major hit. I think she understands that 10 years later, had a few more albums since, many successes, probably understand, oh, well, this is the biggest thing that I will ever do.
Sure.
And we're going to keep it alive, you know? In 2007, Alanis released a cover of the Black Eyed Peas song, My Humps. My Lady.
I remember that. Lumps. It's really funny.
It's mournful and it's accompanied by piano. It's like in black and white, the video.
It's hilarious.
You remember that?
It's supposed to be funny, I assume.
Yeah, it is supposed to be funny.
I mean, it's like satire.
It's satire.
Yeah, it's good.
So she released in 2008. She released her final album for Maverick Records called "Flavors of Entanglement." This was created, she said, out of her grief after the breakup with Ryan Reynolds, who she was dating for a time there for several years. I think they lived together too. In 2010, she married hip hop artist Soul Eye, with whom she has three children. In interviews, Alanis has admitted to being an alpha female.
What does that mean?
I think that means that she's in charge.
Oh, I see.
In 2012, she released an album called Havoc and Bright Lights. In 2015, a collector's edition of Jagged Little Pill was released.
Okay, what's different about it from the non-collector's edition?
There's extra stuff, remastered. I think it's remastered. In 2015, a jukebox musical based on the songs from Jagged Little Pill.
Wait a minute, because she says in interviews it's not a jukebox musical, and I don't know what jukebox musical means.
It just means you're finding a way to throw the songs in.
Oh, like where the songs are already popular and then they are put into a musical. Okay.
Yeah. Just didn't want it to be a typical jukebox musical. I feel like it probably is. I mean, I just seen little clips.
Well, the
of
distinction
it.
That she makes is that it's not about her life. It's a made-up story.
That's right. What's it called? The ABBA.
Mamma Mia.
Mamma Mia is not about ABBA.
No,
it's
it
another
isn't.
Story, and they just work them. It's
yeah.
random story that they.
Isn't
put.
There like a musical of like Pink Floyd's music or like The Who or...
Yeah, there's musicals of basically all these things.
And are they about the musicians or are they...
Sometimes, I think sometimes they are.
Okay.
Sometimes they may be. But anyway, the book was written by Cody Diablo.
Oh yeah, she wrote the movie Juno.
Oh, right, right. Okay. It was
not... And other films.
It was nominated for 15 Tony Awards.
I mean, I think it's about a family, but it's about a group of people who have kind of like every problem in the contemporary conversation that you could...
It's an issues-based musical.
Mm-hmm. And like one thing that I liked about the description of it is that the song Ironic is actually sang ironically in it. So it's like in a scene of a writing workshop where the kids are learning, like where someone says... Rain on your wedding day is ironic, and then everyone makes fun of her because she doesn't know what ironic means. So
it's a play on the fact that the song Ironic is misuses the term irony. We'll get into that a little bit more. Okay. We're almost done with her biography here.
Okay, because so I really want to...
Dig into ironic?
Well, I don't need to dig in. I just need to say that it's caused a lot of problems as a creative writing teacher myself.
All right, we'll get to that in a second. In 2017... Alanis's former business manager, Jonathan Schwartz, was sentenced to 6 years in prison for embezzling $5 million from her.
Oh, dear.
And others. More money from others. In 2020, she reissued the 25th anniversary edition of Check It Little Bill.
Oh, my God.
It just keeps coming back, baby. In 2020... The same year she released a new album. It was her first one in 8 years. It's called Such Pretty Forks in the Road. It features a confessional song about eating and drinking too much. It's called Why I Drink. I kind of like that song. And another that is about loving her children called A Blaze. She performed A Blaze on Jimmy Fallon's show holding one of her kids.
I did watch the video for A Blaze in which she... It's almost like... like an Instagram family post made into a video. Like
very much Instagram mom vibe.
Yeah.
Where you're showing off your kids and stuff.
Totally. Yeah. And like the kids on the trampoline and them all dressed up as... I think they're supposed to be dressed up as cells. Like it's about like DNA and like...
Maybe it's about the pandemic. Because it was filmed at home during the pandemic.
Oh, so. I thought it was supposed to be more about heredity and stuff like that.
Oh, maybe.
But anyway, so they are playing together and she's like looking very happy in that beatific smile of hers.
Oh, yeah.
And her husband and kids are in the video. And there's a line in the song that I thought, a couple of lines, where she says... You might notice that everything is temporary. And then the next line is, and you'll notice that you'll always have a family. So there's this like contradiction with like everything is temporary and you'll always have a family. In other words, that's not temporary. She is saying like everything is temporary, but you'll always have a family. And I feel like that kind of encompasses that, or it's an example of that thing I was saying before. Where it's like everything is... Well, she talks in these kind of Buddhist-type terms about like how, you know, everything is temporary and desire is suffering and, you know, the world of the material world is misery and whatnot. But then she goes on to say, but at the same time, like, you'll always have love and you'll always have family and you can depend on me and everything's going to be fine. So it's like this... Like, it's a little bit of a... Instagram yoga vibe there.
It's new age spirituality.
It's new age spirituality, and she definitely came to it before its time. She was an early adopter of that.
Yeah, I suppose in the 90s. I mean, it was crazy. I remember...
I remember
my dad being really into that stuff.
It's not a philosophically robust position.
It is not.
And it's not a poetically robust...
Composition. I'm not a big
fan. And that's
fan.
Fine, but I just have to, like, I think at the same time, like, it's something that appeals to a lot of people.
Yeah, I agree. I mean...
And, sorry, something else about Alanis, like, from You Ought to Know right up to this A Blaze song, like, even though it may not be philosophically robust or poetically well-composed... it's still sometimes. It gets people at like a gut level, and she's very emotionally intelligent, and she knows how to express that in a way that has a lot of resonance.
Yeah.
A lot of resonance, both like lyrically and musically, for obviously a huge audience. So like picking it apart is rather pointless, I suppose.
Yeah, it's not that rewarding, maybe, to do that. But
I mean, it is what like can be tempting to be like, oh, this sucks because of these things, or this is silly, this is simplistic, this is like pablum or simple-minded. Like, these are the insults that part of me wants to lash out.
But it's the same thing you
but
would
I
say.
I know that it's
It's the same thing
the
you
point.
Might say about lots of self-help literature
or like the poetry, like Instagram poetry.
Motivational speakers.
Yeah.
This is not, from an academic point of view, not super coherent or complete or historically accurate. I mean, talking about everything being just fine, like it's important to think and feel that at times so you can cope.
Mm-hmm.
But that's actually the opposite of the truth. The truth is that... The truth is, we're all going to die.
Yeah, but if...
And that's what art... I mean, this is one of the things that art does tell us in various ways. It makes it okay for us to confront that fact. And
sure.
That the people that, like, grief and loss and death are things that... elements of the real world.
Yeah, but from a Buddhist perspective, or, like, a pseudo-Buddhist perspective, even, like, a New Agey perspective, everything is fine, even though death is inevitable.
So in a recent interview, this was from 2020 as well, it was for Q. So Tom Power interviews her. Again, she's at home zooming in. And the most recent Alanis doesn't talk as much about spirituality as, say, the late 90s one did. But she talks like about therapy. So she has all of these sort of kind of therapy terms and the New Agey spiritual terms as well thrown in. So she talks about consciousness raising, trauma a lot, evolution of the species, not in a scientific way, bodies, awakenings, energy, oneness. These are all the kinds of the vocabulary that she uses in a conversation with Tom Powers, who asks her at the end, what happens to us after we die? And she elaborates about you enter the oneness of the universe, but still somehow you maintain your individuality, which is one of those contradictions. Like, well, how is that possible?
Okay,
anyway, listen, for atheists, maybe it rings a little hollow to talk that way. But I mean, that's not the part of Alanis Morissette that I like.
Mm-hmm.
When I encounter it in her music, I just kind of shut off. I'm like, eh.
Like, I'm familiar with this kind of worldview, but
I think it's ubiquitous.
Yeah.
So this is why we have to really, this is why Alanis, to me, is a very interesting topic. Whatever you think, even about her artistic value, the fact that she's so popular, enduring, with a certain kind of, probably middle class, person,
mm-hmm.
who has kind of grown up along with Alanis and sees their life or their philosophy or their fears and hopes reflected in what she's doing, that to me is very significant.
Mm-hmm.
So all this stuff, I mean, I encounter it all the time. The emphasis on therapy culture, talking a lot about in therapeutic ways and terms, and also combined with a kind of vague spirituality that you can only really describe it as New Age, certainly nothing institutional, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, Alanis is not a Catholic anymore,
mm-hmm,
you know what I
sure.
mean? That is extremely common. And sometimes I don't know how to respond to it,
mm-hmm.
to something that I generally don't share.
Right. But, I mean, you don't have to share it to respect it the way that we... you know, respect other people's belief systems.
I guess this is the place to talk about, maybe, if we are talking about art, what the difference is between art and confession, or I should say art and therapy.
Mm-hmm.
Because Alanis will talk about her songwriting as therapeutic and, mm-hmm. And mention that she knows her audience finds it therapeutic to listen to it and to totally. Identify with it in different ways. Now, I wouldn't deny that art has a therapeutic, can have a therapeutic function, but I wouldn't reduce it to that. What are your thoughts about the relationship between therapy and art?
Well, oh my gosh, it's such a complicated question.
I think this is the heart of Alanis in many ways, is mm-hmm. art and therapy, what's its relationship? If you don't like Alanis for certain reasons, it might have to do with a difference in like an opinion about what you think art is and its relationship to therapy, right?
That's true. I mean, yeah. I was talking earlier about the distinction made by the journalist that I read between therapy and protest in yes. music, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And then I guess art is then yet another third category, and maybe this is a case where this is like a protest music and therapeutic music both fitting into the category of art or something like that. Like, I wouldn't want to say that what Alanis does isn't art because it's therapy. But I do think, I mean, art can, and I mean, I don't know a lot about music, rock music or any other kind of music, really. What I, like, the only art form I really know anything about is literature. Mm-hmm. So that's where I'm coming from whenever I really think about or talk about art. But, like, I definitely think that sometimes art writing can go very badly, can go very wrong, because it was written as therapy for the writer. Mm-hmm. And that is great. I mean, that's a great way to use writing in your life. But then when you offer that to an audience, like, sometimes it doesn't have a lot to offer to other people because it was for yourself.
Yes.
It was for a catharsis, right?
And it's not crafted.
It's not crafted.
And I think I would say her worst lyrics don't feel crafted.
I read that a lot of her lyrics for You Ought to Know or for Jagged Little Pill came from her diary.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not surprising. Mm-hmm. But then again, I think that you can take things from a diary. Like, I've taken material from a diary and then crafted it into something else, right? Like,
yeah.
When I wrote a memoir, I started by basically writing a diary, and then I took some things out of that and crafted them and threw out others. And, you know, so it's not like you can't start that way and end up with art. And she clearly did. I mean, she ended up with something that...
Sure.
You know, is very crafted.
Yeah.
Very, very crafted. So that's like the distinction between art and what can go wrong. That's what can go wrong with when the art was like actually a therapeutic exercise for the artist. But then what she's saying and what she's doing is she's providing a therapeutic experience for her audience.
Yeah.
And that requires craft, right?
It does.
So that's a real art.
To make it relatable, to make it comprehensible to another, for it to communicate to them. And that's also where, to my mind, where the social function of art comes in too, where you feel like you've been, in a way, you've been heard or seen because mm-hmm. someone else is saying something to you that you understand.
And you might not have been able to express yourself, but as soon as you hear it, you're like, yes, that's...
And there's this cathartic thing. I mean, there's always that with an artist too, with a performer especially, mm-hmm. the identification with them, the kind of living vicariously through them in a way, where, you know, you hear someone belt it out. And like, Alanis can really belt it out, man. Mm-hmm. She really can. She's got
and
a big voice.
Just...
And to hear that, you sometimes, like, to hear a singer really belt it out, I sometimes feel like, man, I wish I could sing like that.
Yes, me too.
Like, that would feel so good. Yeah. And you know, you sing along yourself in the quiet of your own home, and that is cathartic, and there is something, I imagine, like, therapeutic to that, too.
Totally. And with Alanis songs, like, when people sing them at karaoke or whatever, or even when we're singing them to each other.
You
Ought to
Know
is
a huge karaoke song.
People tend, like, you can't really just sing it in your own voice. You have to, like, sing it like her.
Yeah.
She has this very specific way of vocalizing, and she also has these like dance, this kind of half dancing, half like heaving thing that she does. And I don't claim this is an original thought because I read it somewhere, but like there's this cathartic element to like the way she sings and the way she moves. Like it's like she's like argh, like getting out this like anger, and it's clearly, I mean, of course, like planned and choreographed and stuff, as well as coming from an authentic place. And seeing her enact this kind of like catharsis is cathartic for the person listening to it and watching it. And that's how a lot of people describe having experienced her as a performer and listening to her albums, you know, like as young people, young women especially, that it was like this cathartic experience of how they felt, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess I think art can go astray when it becomes just confession and just therapeutic function. But yeah, that's not what's happening with Alanis's best work. So like,
no. You
ought to know, like there are like these kind of titillating confessions about, you know, like would she go down on you in the theater? You know, like that kind of thing. I have to say, like, in the context of that song, like, those confessions, they seem kind of brave, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, certainly they are also, they obviously hit a market that was ready for them. That mm-hmm. is, they weren't going to be censored outright. No, the song got huge on radio. But it was, like, shocking enough that it got your attention, that she was saying these things. And so there was something very raw, but something that felt kind of raw about that kind of confession combined with her performance, which is just like growling and screaming and
flailing.
Flailing and her acting in the video is like, she just looks anguished. Like,
yeah.
She's really, really emoting.
Yeah.
And so combined with the lyrics, that makes that song like really hit. Like it sounds great still. Honestly, that song still sounds great. I also think like just going back from her very first song to basically her most recent song, which is Why I Drink, there is a similar power, I think, like a frisson from this confessional,
sure.
where she's talking about, you know, eating too much and drinking too much and how she feels ashamed about mm-hmm. that. And that's relatable. That's extremely relatable feeling. And for a woman, like a famous woman in like the fame industry, like that strikes me as being a brave confession in a world where like you have to like worry so much about your looks and your weight mm-hmm. and stuff like that. So I think there's a similar confessional energy that really works in that later, like that most recent song too. She has good melodies. She can phrase really interestingly and uniquely. Like, you know Alanis's voice when you hear it. And it's also because of the way she says words to make them fit a rhythm and a rhyme,
mm-hmm.
you know? And like, sometimes it might feel a little mannered, but other times you're like, that's really works. And that's totally unique. Never would have thought of saying it that way, but she did. And that comes out of a melodic instinct, you know, to language that she has. So just by way of conclusion here on Alanis, I think I already said a little bit of this. I would just like to like talk about, I guess, her evolution over the years has mirrored what many, I think, middle-class people, like Xers and millennials, how they've changed as well. Like this movement towards spirituality and therapy culture is like a search for meaning, mm-hmm. you know, in the world that we live in, a world that's brutally individualistic and can be crassly consumerist and hollow of these things, hollow of meaning. And so this is a way of trying to find it. And this is extremely popular and extremely common. And I think Alanis is an avatar of that.
An avatar, that's a good word for it.
Thank you.
Yeah, I agree. That's everything you just said is definitely true. And I think she was not just an avatar of it, but a precursor or even a precedent for it, maybe. She kind of, you know, obviously even like the Beatles went to India and did some yoga meditation stuff. So it's not like she was the first one to think of it, but.
No, in the 90s, there was a kind of a 60s, 70s revival.
That's right, there was, yeah. But I mean, I think she certainly made that new age / Buddhist / yoga philosophy her own and mm-hmm. really used her own, and I guess she would use the word trauma and anger and this attitude of self-care and therapy and married them together in this like this very compelling brew,
yeah.
I guess,
yeah.
of, you know, both like not exactly regret, but I suppose a sort of regret, a sort of anger, at the unfairness of life and the way sometimes people treat people and even like the basic structure of reality, and kind of marries that with a coping mechanism and a way of like being serene and content and loving in the face of that. And those are certainly, like, it does certainly seem to be coming from an authentic, genuine place. And like, it must be for her to have had such a long and kind of unwavering cultural impact on so many people.
So Alanis is on tour right now, the tour she was going to do in 2020.
Yes.
It's going on right now.
It sure is.
And my gosh, if Alanis just happens to be coming to Calgary the day after this recording.
That's right.
Tomorrow she'll
be here.
I mean, if the tickets were cheaper, I would go. If we weren't so busy this week, we have a lot going on.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't say no. If someone gave me tickets, I would go.
Oh, me too. Are you kidding? I would love to go.
Yeah.
Well, maybe, you know, eventually we'll have enough patrons on the show that we can afford to
send us to
go on field trips to do research.
That's right. Canadian patreon.com/Canadian Sweater to send us to see Alanis.
Mm-hmm. Maybe, well, it's too late now.
Maybe for the 30th anniversary tour, which is probably coming.
Yeah. This is the
25th anniversary tour.
Okay. Yeah. So we
even
don't
though
have
it's 2 years later than it should be.
Right. Okay. So it's just 3 years until the 30th anniversary tour.
I don't think they're ever going to let Jagged Little Pill go, you know.
And nor should they.
An anniversary will never go uncelebrated, I don't think.
Yeah.
From the Alanis publicity machine.
Okay. Well, thank you, Aaron. I'd like to thank you for bringing Alanis back to my attention. I'm serious. Because I never gave her a chance. No, but seriously, I never gave her a chance. And I think there's a lot more of significance going on there than I wanted to believe. Despite all the nasty things I said.
I feel like that's going to be a refrain for the show. Is seeing things anew.
Yeah.
That you know, changing your mind about them. Something that you haven't thought about in 30 years or something.
Totally.
You know, that you only experienced or first experienced as a kid, and now you see it differently. And so Alanis has been one of those things for me, too. So, you
it
know
really
what,
makes,
Naomi?
Yes.
No, Naomi? Thank you. Thank you, Naomi.
Thank you, Aaron.
Thank you, our four patrons.
Four patrons. Patrons.
Yeah, it's hard to do that thing
that
she does with her voice.
Yeah, that lift at the end of the line. And I think that's
extra power.
It gives it this anthemic feel. And it's like a rise of emotion. It's like we're soaring into transcendence. And I think it's a trick that she does. It really works. It has an emotional, it makes you feel like something just happened that was really, really gut level meaningful.
Sometimes she can sell a pretty banal line.
Yeah.
With that trick.
Yeah.
And it works.
It sure does.
All right. Well, I think that's probably where we should end it.
Sounds good to me, Aaron.
All right. Well, thank you, everybody, for watching and listening. And we'll see you on the next episode.